Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am your host, Ben Popper, joined as I often am by my colleague and collaborator, Ryan Donovan, editor of our blog, maestro of our newsletter. Ryan?
Yes, sir.
We have talked a lot about AI, so we're not going to start with that today. Ooh. I want to hear from you about why configuration can't just be simple.
So this is something that comes up. It's not just, you know, your software settings. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, allowing the software to be a little bit flexible for what the user needs. And it's being able to handle all of the settings, right? The metaphor that they use is, you know, when you have a sink in your apartment, there's all sorts of sort of configurations built into that sink design, right? The depth of it, where the water hits the drain. But, you know, in use, I mean, you may have a bowl and hits the bowl and the water shoots into your shirt, whatever.
Right.
Because there's a fixed faucet. Right. So making that faucet, you know, flexible is adding extra configuration. But, you know, then you have to code that into the product, manage any changes and any changes that affect it. And it's sort of a problem that gets exponentially harder.
Yeah. In your example, which I can relate to as a dad with kids who just throw a bunch of stuff in the sink, you know, one has to adapt to the situation because the sink can't adapt for you. And I think maybe part of the point of this was that if we, you know, went from multi-user systems on some kind of, you know, local network to personal computers to virtual hosts to container clusters, you can now plan services and think about it bottom up. You know, what are the devices and behaviors that are going to be involved? And as those change, you know, can our system adapt?
Yeah. And it's talks about the change, drift, erosion, maintenance issues like garbage collection, like all these things that make it so you can't just have a set static piece of code to handle some change. And, you know, he goes, this is a very deep article, goes into the Euclidean coordinates of the semantic space of changes and talks about promise theory. So, if you would like to get out of your depth on change management, we'll put this link in the show notes.
Autonomous view, I will keep to this. Subordinate view, I will keep what you want. Tell me what you want. You know, we did have a conversation with the CEO of Netlify, which, you know, helps lots of people to build websites, interactive ones, speedy ones. And he espoused a view that I've heard tossed around here and there that we could be headed towards a world of software 2.0, where the UI, the UX are way more flexible and personalized. Right. They can adapt on the fly to what the user is doing, learn from a user mistake and goad them to better understand and make use of and get value out of the software. So this is a deep piece about all of that, but I've also heard people express maybe some optimism recently that some of the technologies coming on board are going to allow this.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that sort of possibility of making changes on the fly or adapting settings, like, you know, the classic text adventure game like Zork, right? It has to program every possible choice, right? And then a couple of years ago, I think it was OpenAI released AI Dungeon, where it had, you know, GPT one or two behind it. And you could say, you know, yeah, I want to kiss the dragon, right? And then it would send you off on a story around, you know, trying to kiss the dragon, then you're shopping clothing and it allows you to pursue the sort of interface you want.
Right. That also has come up, the procedurally generated worlds of certain video games now seem to sprawl out endlessly, and people love No Man's Sky. It was a rough start, but it sort of built steam over time. And that in the future, as we've discussed, these will be not just sort of like infinitely evolving, but each of us could have our own little pocket dimension, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have to live in the MCU.
Right.
Because, it can adapt to us.
Yeah. I mean, that is a sort of promise of AI. It, you know, No Man's Sky sort of caught flack at the beginning for not actually being as procedural and as like varied as it promised.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there have been other games that have sort of toned that down, have given you sort of more directed experiences, right? And I think there's a good middle ground to be found there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was an issue that came up a lot when I worked at The Verge. Mm-hmm. And I know we've discussed it a little bit here on the podcast, but today, Thursday, April 11th, 2024, to give it a timestamp, Apple announced it's opening its iPhone repair process up to include used components.
Okay.
Starting this fall, customers in independent repair shops will be able to fix the handset using anything compatible. This has been a long, slow process of Apple's, you know, very walled garden. The walls are coming down. Mm-hmm. And I guess it remains to be seen whether the consumer will benefit or not.
Yeah.
It is nice that you can now do this. On the other hand, it, you know, opens up the possibility of going to a shady place that promises to repair and gives you some used parts that break on you in a week, right?
Right. I mean, that's always a risk with used stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is a nice step. The right to repair has been a long fought battle, but I think being able to sort of do that yourself
would
be the next step. I've heard that, you know, even with some of the right to repair stuff, doing the repair itself requires, you know, loaning out like a $2,000, you know, heat device to open up the battery pack.
Right. And there's a quote in here from John Ternus, Apple Senior Vice President of Hardware Engineering. Parts pairing is used a lot outside and has this negative connotation. I think it's led people to believe that we somehow block third-party parts from working, which we don't. Mm-hmm. The way we look at it is we need to know what parts are in the device for a few reasons, and one of which seems reasonable to me, we need to authenticate it's a real Apple biometric device, for example, and hasn't been spoofed or something like that. So it is true, you know, that I trust my device to do a lot for me, and I offload the mental work of passwords to my fingerprint and my face ID. Mm-hmm. And if I took my device to a third-party repair shop and they swapped in a spoof that harvested that data, it would be terrible for me.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, I have a desktop PC here that's a bit of a Frankenstein. You know, I've had power supplies die on me and replace those and put in new memory chips. And they're all of different origins. They're all different companies.
Right.
And I think, like, that's the power of shared standards, right? They're not just saying, oh, this has to be all the same company. It's like, it has to work together. It has to play nice, but...
So do you have anything biometric on your PC or no?
No.
Do you live in a Faraday cage or no?
No, not yet, but my kitchen does have a little bit of a Faraday cage going on.
So I mentioned The Verge where I used to work, and our friend Ira shared a good link here. I've been having a debate with a friend of mine, you know, is Gen AI really changing the world or not? You know, is it more just hype and substance? This story says Texas plans to replace 4,000 people and save $15 to $20 million a year by having a large language model do the grading of its state assessment tests. So all the kids every year will have to write these exams and these essays. And the system has been trained on 3,000 exam responses that already got two rounds of human grading, and they will be spitting out the pass or fail.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting... It's definitely... I appreciate the workload is taking off of teachers, right? Teachers are underpaid, overworked.
Yeah.
And it allows for, you know, more than just like a Scantron test where you can guess and get it right a quarter of the time.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think as we've talked about, a lot of these AI systems just sort of like converge on a mean, right?
Right.
It's going to just be a specific writing style. There's going to be ways to game it. You're just writing for the AI, like, you know, old school SEO stuff.
Right. Yeah. You know, like, all the great old things of Bart Simpson or PCU, somebody gets their hand on the exam, you know, questions beforehand. Now somebody will get their hands on, right, like what essay was preferred by the AI, and you'll have to imitate that style.
Right. What's the training data?
Yeah, exactly.
So ran across some interesting discussions on Stack Overflow. This one about what's the best beginner programmer language. Mm. You know, and I think that's something everybody's looking for. What's the one to start? And I think when I started in college, we did C++ briefly, and then Java. And Java was the newest hotness at the time. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of places have moved to Python because it is sort of that easier readable one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think also like academically, you know, things have shifted. And so it's kind of like a chicken and an egg thing, but like academia sees industry shifting, then academia switches to teaching Python more mm-hmm. often than they would teach C or Java. And then students come out with those skills. And so startups, you know, tend to gravitate towards them. I guess Python also seems to be a good fit in the world of data science and machine learning. And since that's the hotness these days, you know, has more applicability to a lot more different careers, right?
Yeah. And I think this discussion is interesting because most of the top answers are saying C++, Java, but it takes a while to get down to JavaScript. And JavaScript is used everywhere.
Right.
And I know there's a lot of sort of frustration with JavaScript as a language. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a reason not to start with JavaScript.
Right. I guess also maybe like people are asking this in terms of like, what's going to get me, you know, a high paying job? JavaScript seems like the kind of thing where a lot of people learn it on their own or through a boot camp, and maybe there's more competition. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, those are actually two different questions, right? Like, what's the best to learn programming and what's going to get me the best results in the field, right?
Right.
Because I think, like, you can get a programming language that conveys a lot of interesting programming concepts in a really good way. Mm-hmm. Or you can get one that is useful in the real world. And maybe the two shall meet.
Ryan.
Yes, sir.
I think we talked about this company Beeper once before. It was a company that was trying to integrate iOS and Android messages. Mm. And they were having sort of a back and forth with Apple about it. They were just recently acquired by Automattic, the company behind WordPress. And I think this is, to our earlier point, a bet that a regulatory shift is underway, that as the walled garden comes down and people look to build these bridges, there will be a big business here. So I thought that was an interesting one. Also, not sure what Automattic has to do with this, but
you know, I think they are maybe just guessing. They are invested in open platforms. Mm-hmm. I think WordPress is a pretty open platform, but yeah, I mean, if these messaging platforms are going to stop fighting apps on top of them, mm-hmm. I think that's a win for everybody. But is that a trend? Are we going to see, you know, Facebook syndicating on the Fediverse?
You know, I'm not holding my breath, but yeah, you never know. One chat to rule them all.
There you go.
I guess I wouldn't mind. Yeah,
and I think, you know, if that does happen, there's going to be a fight to create the best platform with best features, and I think that's something where the user is going to win. Right.
Right.
Down with vendor lock-in. Mm-hmm.
This is an important public service announcement from Tech Debt Will Never Die. San Francisco, the city most associated with Silicon Valley and the heart of technology and innovation in the United States, has a public transit system called the Muni. Mm-hmm. And it runs on 5.25-inch floppy disks. And it will until 2030, because it will take that long to shift over.
Yeah. It's definitely tough to move off of legacy systems when you need to be running it in production. I've heard that airplane scheduling systems ran on, you know, ancient mainframes for years after that was reasonable. I don't know if they do anymore, but if something is mission critical all the time, you can't switch it over to, you know, a sleek cloud system
right
while the buses are in motion.
The buses are part of the Muni's Metro automatic train control system, which are tied into things like propulsion and braking. So right, literally in motion, as you would say. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, says one floppy disk defender. Floppy disk apologist.
Yeah. Why do you need the latest, greatest technology? Buses run on time.
Right.
That's fun.
All right, everyone. It is that time of the show. We want to shout out a user who came on Stack Overflow and contributed a little knowledge. As you may know, Stack Overflow has done some licensing deals to have this data help train AI. And we think an ethical approach to AI is to recognize the humans in the loop to make sure some of the value from whatever the AI does comes back into the community. So, Hobbs, H-O-B-B-S, awarded March 31st. A stellar answer badge. This answer was so good, it was saved by 100 users. How do I change the URL for a remote Git repository? A great answer that has helped. You want to take a guess? This might be the most I've ever seen.
Really? 100,000?
4.1 million times this question has been
used. Oof.
So that's a lot of people that have been reached with a good answer.
That's right.
Congratulations, Hobbs, for providing one and for your badge.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. As always, I am Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow. Thanks so much for listening. Reach out to me on X at Ben Popper. Email us with questions or suggestions for the show, podcast@StackOverflow. And if you enjoyed yourself, leave us a rating and a review because it really helps.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find it at stackoverflow.blog. And if you want to reach out to me on X, you can find me at rthordonovan.
Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon.